Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Ira Melman reporting some possibly telling words from the new leader of the Taliban. An apparent attempt by the new leader of the Taliban to reassure his members has led to some questions. An audio recording from the new leader, Mullah Akhtar Mansour, sent to VOA along with some other news organizations, says the Taliban jihad will continue until the Islamic system is brought to Afghanistan. Mansour also says in the recording that the Taliban leadership will make all efforts to maintain internal unity at all costs. He said Mullah Omar gave him all the responsibilities while he was still alive, so he is simply continuing the mission as instructed by the late leader. Mansour's emphasis on maintaining unity in the Taliban appears to give credence to reports that his appointment has caused some rifts in the Islamic insurgent group. He says all decisions will be taken in light of Islamic law, be it war or peace talks, and advised his followers not to pay attention to rumors being spread about the Taliban campaign. Mansour replaced Taliban founder Mullah Mohammed Omar, whose death has been confirmed by the Taliban, although the timing of the death remains unclear. The vice president of Yemen, Khaled Baha, Saturday became the most senior official from Yemen's exiled government to visit since local fighters drove out Iranian-backed Shiite Houthi rebels. Mr. Baha was scheduled to chair a cabinet meeting Saturday with seven government ministers in Aden, according to a Yemeni official. Flew to Aden from the Saudi capital of Riyadh, where the Yemeni government has been based since President Abdul Rabu Mansour Hadi fled to Houthi advance in Aden in March. You are listening to VOA News. The U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry has arrived in Cairo for talks about security issues and regional terrorism, including the threat posed by Islamic State extremists. Kerry arrived late Saturday in the Egyptian capital, his first stop on a five-nation tour of the Middle East and Southeast Asia. VOA's Pam Dawkins takes a look at the first two legs of the Kerry journey.
His trip to Cairo comes at a time when the United States and Egypt have been working to mend relations strained by U.S. opposition to Egypt's repression of supporters of ousted President Mohamed Morsi. The two countries will host a strategic dialogue focusing on political, economic, and security issues. In Qatar, Kerry will meet with Gulf Cooperation Council members who have raised concerns about the Iran nuclear deal. Pam Dawkins, VOA News, the State Department.
A wing flap suspected to be from the missing Malaysia Airlines Flight 370 has arrived at a French military testing facility where it will be analyzed by experts. A truck brought the roughly 8-foot or 2.5-meter component known as a flaperon to the DGATA aeronautical testing site near Toulouse, accompanied by police motorcycles and a police car. French aviation experts will try to establish whether the wreckage that was found in the Indian Ocean island of Reunion does come from the Boeing 777, which disappeared on March 8th of 2014 while en route from Kuala Lumpur to Beijing with 239 people on board. The experts, including a legal expert, will start their inquiry on Wednesday, according to the prosecutor's office. Wildlife authorities in Zimbabwe say they have suspended the hunting of lions, leopards, and elephants in an area favored by hunters following the killing of a lion popular with tourists. The National Parks and Wildlife Authority said Saturday that bow and arrow hunts have also been suspended unless they're approved by authorities' director. The authority says it also is investigating the killing of another lion in April that may have been illegal. It says it only received the information this week. That announcement follows an international outcry stemming from an American hunter's killing of a lion named Cecil that was allegedly lured out of a national park. Zimbabwean authorities say the hunt was illegal and are seeking the extradition of the Minnesota dentist Walter James Palmer. Indians and Bangladeshis are celebrating the end of a 68-year state of limbo for tens of thousands of people living along the porous border joining the two nations. At 1 minute after midnight Saturday, local time, India and Bangladesh exchanged more than 150 islands of territory, Bangladesh in India and Indian in Bangladesh, isolated since independence since 1947.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
Vaccine that will prevent and get the virus of Ebola to zero. We welcome that as a government, and we hope that we are ready as a nation.
The Sierra Leonean government welcomes the results of the promising Ebola vaccine trial in neighboring Guinea.
We want to team up together with all the forces of change, like political parties, so that for once and for all, we get rid of President Museveni and his system.
The Kampala Lord Mayor aims to unite all opposition groups to challenge Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni and his ruling party in the general election next year.
On a formé les gens également dans la fabrication des charrettes. Bon, quant à l'achat de...
With its North Kivu project, he says, FAO has trained ex-combatants in animal traction.
And aid workers in the Democratic Republic of Congo are using animals to transport goods and people in poor road conditions. We'll have details, those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Welcomed the announcement by researchers that an Ebola vaccine experiment in neighboring Guinea showed effectiveness at preventing the disease. Abdoulaye Barete's spokesman for the government comments came after the World Health Organization said Friday that early tests of a vaccine against Ebola showed a 100% success rate. Sierra Leone, Liberia, and Guinea are the three West African countries mostly affected by the disease. Barete told me that health workers, including doctors and nurses in Sierra Leone at the Ebola front lines, died battling the disease.
The news that just came as reported through WHO that a vaccine is showing the efficacy of a way of a vaccine that will prevent and get the virus of Ebola to zero. We welcome that as a government. And we hope that we are ready as a nation to work with our international development partners because of the simple reason that sometimes wherever Ebola has occurred once, there is always a possibility for a recurrence. Though we don't hope that for Sierra Leone, Liberia, and Guinea, but I think this is welcome news across the board.
Is there a collaboration with the ongoing Ebola vaccine trial in neighboring Guinea following this recent news?
Of course. We have always been collaborating through the regional efforts in the fight against the virus itself. Sierra Leone, Liberia, and Guinea, through the support of the United Nations Ebola response teams established in the three countries, we have always been sharing epidemiological evidence and data. And in fact, there was a vaccine that was brought to Sierra Leone whereby we tested it on our own frontline workers to see its efficacy. And if today Guinea, after such a trial is being tested, is showing very positive signs that indeed it could be a potential vaccine for getting to zero in terms of infections, I think we salute all those that have contributed to that effort. And we as a government will always be ready to collaborate so that that way we can also contribute to the eradication and eventual stemming the tide of the virus even in the future.
Now, we also heard reports that the Sierra Leone opposition party has threatened with their legislators not to approve or re-approve the presidential directive concerning the fight against Ebola in Sierra Leone. What can you tell me about this, and was this resolved?
Well, absolutely, you are correct. The Sierra Leone People's Party, which is the main opposition in Sierra Leone, came out with a press release 2 days ago requesting their members of parliament not to support any new directives that will be presented to parliament by the president for the continued implementation of the Ebola regulations under the public state of emergency. And they also made a lot of barrage of allegations that the very public state of emergency was a way to for the government to perpetuate itself and also an extension for the presidency. We saw those as very misplaced approach and comments, the reason being there is no inextricable link between the public state of emergency and the politics of the country. The reason being, since we came into governance in 2007, we have never for once promulgated a public state of emergency, but in 2014 as a result of the Ebola. So the president, as usual, convened a meeting of all political parties to have a dialogue. And after explaining the rationale, and of course the opposition party, the SLPP and their colleagues, they had to withdraw their threat and that they are ready, rather making a passionate appeal to the president to make sure that we relax some of the measures being in place. And this has been the practice of President Koroma, because there was a time when the APA, of which the Sierra Leone People's Party is part and parcel, they made a presentation to the president that they wanted the measures relaxed. The president said, well, I'm going to consult with the epidemiologist who will be able to advise me if we are going to relax those measures. And after consulting with the epidemiologist, the president had to release. And yesterday's meeting, he congratulated all the political parties that if today Sierra Leone is almost defeating the virus, it is not just the singular achievement of the government, but all political parties because of their unflinching support.
Abdoulaye Barete is a spokesman for the Sierra Leonean government. He spoke with me from the capital, Freetown. The World Health Organization, WHO, says work is moving ahead on a plan to reform the organization's ability to respond speedily and effectively to international health emergencies. For VOA, Lisa Schlein has more from the WHO headquarters in Geneva.
These reforms have been triggered by worldwide criticism of the World Health Organization's slow response to the Ebola epidemic in West Africa. The WHO's Director General, Margaret Chan, did not declare Ebola an international public health emergency until August 8, 2014. This was more than 4 months after Guinea had declared Ebola a national health emergency. The deadly virus subsequently spread to Sierra Leone and Liberia, killing nearly 1,000 people in the region by the time WHO responded. Dr. Chan says WHO will be implementing reforms in six main areas.
First, the development of a unified program for emergency. Internally, within the organization, we are implementing faster, more streamlined internal procedures for procurement, for staff deployment, and the management of our global resources to speed up the response to any emergency. We are already seeing the results of this streamlining in our response to outbreaks and emergencies in Yemen, Nepal, and the Republic of Korea.
WHO says it also plans to help countries create resilient health systems. It will establish a global health emergency workforce that can quickly respond to international health emergencies. Dr. Chan says a fourth area of work is aimed at enhancing the implementation of the international health regulations.
By this, I mean developing a mechanism to sound the alarm earlier and determining whether this is a way, I mean, there is a way to create mechanisms, incentives for countries to report outbreaks early.
Dr. Chan says WHO will continue research and development of vaccines and treatments of current and emerging diseases. She agrees implementing these reforms will be costly, but she says she is confident the money will be found. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The Lord Mayor of Uganda's capital, Kampala, has established a truth and justice platform that aims to unite opponents of President Yoweri Museveni. This, he says, is to aggressively and assertively seek political and electoral reforms ahead of next year's elections. Arias Lukwago told me that it is time the ruling National Resistance Movement, or NRM, stay in power, be broken to allow what he calls a proper constitutional succession.
It's a platform for truth and justice, and the main purpose is to mobilize Ugandans to join hands with the Democratic Alliance so that we can dismantle the dictatorship we have in this country, because all we have is personal rule. He has personalized all the institutions and is preparing to rig elections. So we want to team up together with all the forces of change, like political parties, so that for once and for all, we get rid of President Museveni and his system.
Supporters of the NRM are saying that the opposition appears to always criticize the government for failing to mobilize and to competitively challenge President Museveni during elections. So accusations of him winning elections are unfounded, and that you should get your house together before throwing mud in the air. What do you say to that?
They are entitled to their view, but we have done our best to play by the rules of the game. But unfortunately, President Museveni has entrenched impunity in the country. We have heard pronouncements from courts of law to the effect that the elections we have had have not been free and fair. They have not lived up to the standards as enshrined in our constitution. And he has instituted a rigging machinery so that elections are just a mere ritual.
Lord Mayor Lukwago, the question then becomes, why will opposition groups participate in elections that the opposition groups themselves say it is neither free nor fair, and it's tantamount to being rigged, and these elections do not meet stipulations enshrined in the Constitution? Why participate in fraud?
Well, we are placed between a rock and a hard surface. You have no choice, because we are, in the past we tried a boycott, but it didn't work out. You know, we have a dictatorship which has lost all sense of shame. You will boycott. We have had walkouts in parliament. We have boycotted civic processes like this, but they continue unabated. And the international community would not come to our rescue. They would simply say, please, do proceed with the elections, because that's the only way out. We cannot indulge in subversive activities. Of course, that would be taking the country to a wrong direction. We do not want to indulge in unconstitutional means. So the only option we have is to go through these elections. Yes, I appreciate, and there are those voices that would call for a boycott, but it's not feasible. It will be ill-advised. So what we are doing this time round is to push for reforms, and that's why we have come up with the notion that we must have elections, but after we have carried out political reforms, not merely electoral or legal reforms, but political reforms. And that's what we are pushing for, despite the challenges we are facing.
Looking at this platform of truth and justice that you have launched, how different will it be from all other opposition or so-called opponents of President Museveni have launched?
Well, there is value addition it's bringing on the political spectrum of this country, in that it's a platform that is mobilizing particular actors within the political circles who feel like somehow they have been left out of particular processes, in particularly the Democratic Party and other political formations, and they feel they should make a contribution to the struggle for change, yet they do not have a vehicle, they do not have a forum where they can express themselves, where they can go into activism. Because what we need right now is political action, and that's what we are emphasizing. And political parties, for example, they deal with more of the ordinary activities. It's not like civil action and to be assertive, to be more aggressive, and so on and so forth. So this what this platform brings on table, to be more assertive, to be more aggressive, to push for change.
Arias Lukwago is the Lord Mayor of the Ugandan capital, Kampala. He spoke with me from Kampala. Academics from around the continent have converged in Johannesburg for the African University Summit. a chance to tackle some of the major issues facing higher education in Africa today, like brain drain, funding, how to improve research, and how to develop cities to draw in more students. VOA's Anita Power reports from Johannesburg.
Africa's quest for development would not be complete, academics say, without a hard look at the continent's burgeoning and struggling higher education system. Academics who gathered this week at the University of Johannesburg say that from the Cape to Cairo, a lack of funding, poor infrastructure, and excessive demand make the task of educating Africa students harder than it has to be. For engineering professor David Mfananga, a vice chancellor at the University of Dar es Salaam in Tanzania, the main problem is the sheer numbers.
Most countries are trying to increase the number of university graduates because it is important for economic development. But the resources are limited, so that affects quality as well. And therefore, we are struggling to balance the two because you need the quantity, you need more graduates, but you need to maintain the quality, and the resources are limited.
Pinky Mehwe, an administrator at the University of Johannesburg, says schools face another problem, money. Like many American universities, she says, African universities struggle for funding. But unlike their American counterparts, many African institutions cannot rely on tuition to fill that gap. The 2009 global economic crisis also tightened African governments' belts, she says, and universities have suffered.
We've seen some of the funding from governments being shaved off, going down, institutions have had to find ways of looking for alternatives, making up for this lack. And so that, I would say, is also a much more generalized but very, very important, you could say even fundamental problem and issue for the development of higher education.
Mfananga says advocating for higher education can be an uphill battle on a continent that often struggles with graver problems like war, famine, poverty, and political instability. But, he says, a better standard of university education holds the solution to many of these problems.
You cannot have development without creating knowledge and transferring knowledge. If you look at most countries that are developed, they are well known for the quality of their universities and graduates and the number of graduates.
But, says Ousmane Sen, director of the Senegal-based West African Research Center, governments also need to look at the end result of churning out university graduates. If they don't expand employment opportunities, he says, governments could exacerbate the very problems education seeks to address.
What are you going to do with them if they just get out of university and they are out of a job? Because this is a real threat. This is a real conflict-ridden situation in Africa, having these thousands and thousands of graduates, postgraduate students, qualified with plenty of degrees, expecting everything from society and spending years milling the ground without getting a decent job. That's a real problem.
None of these challenges will be solved overnight. But African academics say they are no less urgent than many of the continent's other pressing problems. And in this case, solving this problem may help solve the others. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Aid workers in the Democratic Republic of Congo are trying to introduce an ancient practice using animals to transport goods and people. Animal traction, as it is called, is not a tradition in Congo, but the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization says that in areas where roads are bad, it could take a load off people's backs, especially that of women. For VOA, Nick Long has more from Mbakana in the Western DRC.
The Food and Agriculture Organization recently sent a film crew to Bankana, where there's a training school for draft animals. FAO then sent the film to North Kivu in eastern DRC, where it's promoting the use of bullock carts, as many of the roads there are impassable to cars and trucks. Michel Ndwako is head trainer at the school at Bankana. We, the older generation, are soon going to depart, he tells VOA, and we must pass on our knowledge. It's useful knowledge in rural areas, he says. Instead of women carrying heavy burdens, they can yoke the bullocks to the cart, and instead of men working with hoes, they can plough with draft animals. A group of students from Kinshasa's premier state university, UNIKIN, has come to see the training. And Dwako introduces them to a pair of bulls.
Et puis, maintenant, on leur parle en langue du village. Mais ici, nos bêtes sont dressées en langue française. Quand on dit à droite...
The one on the left is Robin, named after the Dutch footballer, he says, and the one on the right is Cowbell, because he's multicoloured. Dwako said normally it's recommended to use bullocks, neutered or castrated bulls for this kind of work, but bulls and cows, as well as horses and mules, are sometimes used. The bulls answer to commands, which they are taught by tugging at their nose rings with ropes.
Ici, nos bêtes sont dressées à langue française. Quand on dit à droite, on tire la corde à droite.
Here the animals are trained in French, says Ndwako. When you say left, you pull to the left, right, you pull to the right, forwards, backwards, and stop. The bulls are yoked together with a wooden block, but can still gore the unwary with their horns.
Je voulais mener cette bête. Vous voyez? Toujours la prudence.
You see, says Ndwako, as Cowbell lunges sideways, the first rule is prudence. The team sets off ploughing, but the yoke breaks. It is quickly fixed, however, and Cowbell is replaced with a more docile bull. Go and keep to the furrow, Ndwako shouts. Bankana is not a remote village. It's on the main road 100 kilometres from Kinshasa, and local people mainly use tractors for ploughing. Bullocks can't really compete here, as it costs roughly the same to hire a tractor and driver as to hire a pair of bullocks and their handler to plough 1 hectare, $75. But bullocks are used for transporting goods from outlying villages to Bankana, says a local teacher, Diodone Chani. Those villages are far off, he says, and cars and trucks rarely go there. But with the bullock cart, the villagers can bring their produce to the main road. VOA went to one of those outlying villages and saw a broken-down cart along the way and one other cart in the village. Motorbike taxi driver Jean-Bosco Mbama told VOA the carts had been very useful to local people, but by 2013 they'd fallen into disrepair and no one knows how to mend them. Another problem, he said, was that the bullocks, bought with aid money, were not strong enough.
When you give, for example, you buy a bull for $800,
the aid, he says, was supposed to be spent on bullocks worth $800 each, but in fact they bought ones worth $400 or $500 and pocketed the rest of the money. FAO spokesman Xavier Fahe says the agency was not involved in animal traction projects in this area.
On a formé les gens également dans la fabrication des charrettes. Bon, quant à l'achat de...
With its North Kivu project, he says, FAO has trained ex-combatants in animal traction and building carts, and its experts have provided 20 of the recommended type of bullock. This pilot project, funded by South Korea, has now ended, but the agency hopes to expand it. Nick Long for VOA News, Kinshasa.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa, we'll introduce you to some of the continent's best and brightest as we spotlight the 2015 Class of Mandela Washington Fellows. Join host Shaka Sali and his guests on Wednesday at 18:30 UTC as they discuss U.S. President Barack Obama's Young African Leaders Initiative. That's next time on VOA Africa.
Next on Let's Talk, join host Sunday Shomari and his guests discussing home-brewed drinks. This lighthearted show covers topics of your interest with some hilarity. Let's Talk comes to you Mondays at 17:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. And then we'll have commentary by Dr. Suleiman Nyang, Professor of African Studies and Comparative Politics at Howard University. And right now it's time for music from our African collection. Enjoy what we have for you today.
Chaco, Juan Gumarati, Matos. kisonone kapo kwangu simanzi ai tatu kidonda chako kwangu maradi oyani kisonone kapo kwangu simanzi kwa mahaba ulonipa nimenokewa vurugu patashika ai punguza kidogo na mengine kadhalika toto suna nyelewa apo apo liposhika ukiongeza kidogo mwenza kota unjuna
ask you whether woman go there.
For sure.
She be woman go there. Shall a woman they make you the
security one day?
Security one day.
Security one.
Shall a woman they make you the
security one day?
Security one day.
Security one.
Shall a woman they make you the
security one day?
Security one day.
Security one.
Shall a woman they make you the
security one day?
Security one day.
Security one.
Still emphasizing, just the analyzing, hypnotizing. It's the hidden strength of a woman. Shy, looking at you, not getting good. You go make plenty sense if you roll my boat. Don't want to pan it, pan up, babe. Don't be come, baby, up, babe. Oh, now, hula, no, hula, no, hula, no, hula, no, no, the end down, though. From the garden of Eden, don't they know be today. Beauty, they brought it through it. Boys, don't they give my role. I'm a little, baby, up, oh. We the made it drop, baby. Anything where you did. My brother, yeah. Woman go there,
for sure.
I say woman go there. If you invite purpose to your party, then go ask you whether woman go there,
for sure.
She be woman go there. Shall a woman they make you the
security one day,
security one day,
security one.
A woman they make you the
security one day,
security one day,
security one.
Shall a woman they make you the
security one day,
security one day,
security one.
Shall a woman they make you the
security one day,
security one day,
security one.
The woman go there, it's not in the cry, yeah, eh. The woman go there, if hunger, eh, but down, yeah, eh. The woman be say, man go succeed, you go fail, yeah, eh.
Don't underestimate her power.
As for my beautiful lady, me I go love you, well, well, I go to you, sorry, sorry, make we they go, I'm gonna get my paro. Cause without you, baby, man, no lonely, yeah, eh. Anything where you they do, my brother, yeah.
Woman go there,
for sure.
I say woman go there,
woman go there. If you invite purpose to your party, then go ask you whether woman go there,
for sure.
She be woman go there. Shall a woman they make you the
security one day,
security one day,
security one day.
A woman they make you the
security one day,
security one day,
security one.
Shall a woman they make you the
security one day,
security one day,
security one.
Shall a woman they make you the
security one day,
security one day,
security one.
Control, no, 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 no
said I like the way you roll. You can make me do some soul.
And that was music from the continent. We hope you enjoyed it. It's now time for commentary and analysis by Dr. Suleiman Nyang, Professor of African Studies and Comparative Politics at Howard University here in Washington. Hello, Dr. Nyang.
Hello, Africa. It's always a pleasure for me to share my reflections on U.S. policy towards Africa. At the same time, I pay close attention to African opinions on an attitude towards the United States. This week, Americans and other people around the planet will look back at the visit of President Barack Hussein Obama to Kenya. Much will be written about it in various newspapers around the world, particularly in the United States. And American historians and scholars and journalists and bloggers who look at this development will put forth their respective understandings and perspectives. I will begin by saying to the audience that the visit to Kenya was significant on many points. Number one, it has a biographical fact in the sense that Obama's father came out of Kenya. And today, all scholars, all people who talk about the journey will remember the Cold War and how the Cold War contributed to the phenomena we're describing today. That will take us back to the presidency of John Kennedy. and his brother, Robert F. Kennedy, when they tried to grapple with serious issues at the time, Obama was just born then. And history in its ways of taking metaphors, analogies, and similes, and anecdotes for those who look at the human condition to see the journey of Obama to Kenya, not only a literal experience, not a dream, but something that Hollywood would have a hard time trying to come up with narratives to capture what happened from John Kennedy to Barack Hussein Obama. And I will point out that the historians, scholars who look at the narrative, to try to connect many dots. When Obama was born and Kennedy was president, America was grappling with the Cuban crisis. Lo and behold, God, the greatest movie maker himself who makes videos, take this young man whose father was from Kenya and his mother was white American, will be the one who will deal with the Cuban crisis, which is now solved after many years of diplomacy and negotiation. And as a result of that development today, Obama has inherited an America very much affected by the Latin American narrative, to the point today there are more Latinos in America than black Americans. Obama is put in this situation, and many black people in the United States and Africans on the continent will see him as the first black president in the United States. Lo and behold, America is still dancing around the narratives that were constructed by Teddy Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson. And Obama is caught in the same dancing ring. Coming back to Teddy Roosevelt, who in his way went to Kenya on safari, it didn't occur to him that one day a child of Kenya, where he was sitting under settler colonialism in Kenya and South Africa and elsewhere, would be president of the United States. That's history today. Today, Americans are negotiating as to whether who will come after Obama. It will be a Latino. Someone from Cuba is running. Who knows God's mystery? All is miracle. The Cuban American might be president after Obama. We don't know. We have to wait and see. So what is very interesting about this narrative is that history has some very funny ways. Those who are looking at Obama going to Africa have to pay into account that when Obama colored to Kenya, Kenya was a settler colony. Today, Obama went to Kenya as a free country, independence, and they have the son of Jomo Kenyatta, president of Kenya. It never dawned on Jomo Kenyatta that one day the president of the United States coming to his country will be of Luo origin. And today, Americans are facing another reality. The Iran issue is also a very interesting narrative that connects the life of Barack Hussein Obama and other sitting presidents, President Jimmy Carter. When Carter was president of the United States, human rights were very important for him. Idi Amin from Africa was one of the targets that was opposed by President Carter. And in the end, Idi Amin is gone. Obama inherited the narrative of dictatorship, authoritarianism. And today, Obama, before he completes his term, will be dealing with term limits, authoritarianism, repressive regimes, and regimes that until Obama gets out of office, whoever comes after him is going to inherit the Obama narratives. Obama has dealt with the Cuban crisis, is gone. The Iranian issue, which is a big issue for Americans with regard to nuclear weapons, the legacy of John Kennedy, and the resolution of the Cuban missile crisis is back with us. So we come back to the last point to be made here. When Obama came out of Kenya, he has to challenge the other African leaders. He solved two problems for himself. When they invited the African leaders, they couldn't invite those people who were barred from entering America. I call them political lepers on American political language. The president of Zimbabwe, Mugabe, couldn't come here when Obama invited. But he had to deal with Mugabe, who was the chairman of the African Union in South Africa, and then they were going to meet in Ethiopia. So that's an other resolution for Obama, that he dealt with that issue. The big issue now is, will the Americans put enough pressure on Mugabe and the other leaders of the African Union that if you want to come back to Washington, all of you, you have to have a program that will make it attractive so that corruption, which has been a major issue that made American business people allergic to business trade you know, Africa. Now that the Chinese are coming to Africa, if the Americans are going to negotiate with the Africans vis-a-vis the Chinese, they have to work a new deal with Africa. And that should be the number one problem, President Obama. Let's deal with the Iranian issue. Let's deal with the fears of the Israelis. And let us create a new dialogue between Africa and the United States.
Thank you very much, Dr. Nyang. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor Shaka Sali, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Odette Frazier, and engineer for today, John Dryden, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, the mosquito that perches on the scrotum must be chased away with caution. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
4 years ago this month, South Sudan celebrated its independence with much jubilation and great hope that a split from the North would finally put an end to decades of civil war. That, unfortunately, was not to be. The relative peace that followed lasted all of 18 months. In December 2013, a political schism evolved into widespread conflict that, in part, devolved along ethnic lines. The conflict is remarkable in its brutality against civilians. This has been stated in a number of reports from NGOs and the United Nations that take note of human rights violations and abuses committed by both sides. They range from ethnically motivated murders to gang rapes and the mass destruction and looting of civilian property. Thousands have been killed, 2.4 million have been displaced, and almost 4.6 million are in need of humanitarian aid. On June 27th, the United States urged the United Nations Security Council to blacklist six rival commanders from South Sudan for threatening that country's peace and stability. On the government side, they are Major General Mario Changwang Yaw Mangwak, Lieutenant General Gabriel Jok Riak, and Major General Santino Dengwal. Rebel leaders to be sanctioned are Major Generals Simon Gatwich Dual, James Koang Chual, and Peter Gadet. In a July 1st vote, the Security Council agreed. All six had previously been sanctioned by our Treasury Department regarding their financial transactions. South Sudan's political leadership has squandered the international goodwill that accompanied its independence and pursued political and economic self-interest that has produced only violence, displacement, and suffering for the South Sudanese people, said U.S. Permanent Representative to the United Nations Samantha Power. Political and military leaders on all sides of this conflict must put aside their self-serving ambitions, end the fighting, and engage in negotiations to establish a transitional government.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.